Thanks very much indeed, Bernie. I hope you can all hear me right at the back. Looks as if you can. It's good of you all to come out on a dark November evening to hear a talk about science. I must say I'm impressed with the cultural activity, the cultural health of the Crieff area, that so many are willing to come out and do that today. You know, this world is often a confusing and perplexing place, is it not? A university student was seen with a large K on his T-shirt. And when someone asked him, what's the K for? What does it stand for? He said, confused. But the questioner replied, you don't spell confused with a K. The student answered, you don't know how confused I am. Now, the White Queen, one of Lewis Carroll's Looking Glass characters, said, sometimes I've believed as many as six impossible things before breakfast. Now, most people are not so comfortable with contradictions, and they try to arrive at some personal worldview which helps them make sense of reality and guides them in how they'll lead their life. On the one hand, we have the naturalist worldview, that sees nature as all that there is. The universe, created out of nothing in a big bang, then stars and galaxies accreted, all accounted for by the grand universal laws of physics. On certain planets, the neo-Darwinian mechanism took over, molecules evolved, and eventually man, that's us, arrived on the scene, with our consciousness and our intelligence. Following this scenario into the future, the human race will eventually die out, will inevitably die out, either because a more advanced life form with whom we can't compete will evolve, they'll regard us more or less as we regard the apes, we'll become extinct, possibly because our ecological niche disappears. In the long term, our sun is expected to swell up into a red giant star, and it will engulf the Earth, and in fact it will engulf almost the whole solar system, eventually leaving just a cold and dead black dwarf remnant in its place. In this atheist scenario, the most likely fate for the whole universe is similar. They call it heat death. Continual expansion of the universe and cooling until there's only cold, motionless, lifeless blackness. No God in heaven, no immortality, no ghost in the machine. I know I've shown one, but no ghost in the machine. As far as the individual is concerned, death's the finish. Since there's no God, no immortality, then everything is quickly forgotten. All our ideas and achievements are lost in oblivion. There are no imperishable records. I mean, even the pyramids will crumble into dust one day. So even geniuses like Robert Burns or James Clerk Maxwell, everything they did, everything they accomplished, will be forgotten. There'll be no one to remember. And it'll be the same for the whole human race. All the triumphs of art, literature, science, technology, they can leave no record. They won't be remembered. It'll all sink into the silent indifference of the cosmos. No matter how much good you did, no matter how brilliant your contribution to society, it'll all be for nothing. If you had never existed, if I had never existed, never lived, it would really make no difference in the long run. If the human race had never evolved, it would make no difference. If the Big Bang had never happened, no difference. This makes life seem meaningless and pointless and purposeless, and it's given rise to the existential despair that we see so much of in modern art and modern society. Furthermore, there can be no moral absolutes. as Richard Dawkins so graphically put it in his book, in a universe of blind physical forces and genetic replication, some people are going to get hurt, other people are going to get lucky, and you won't find any rhyme or reason in it, nor any justice. There is at bottom no design, no purpose, no evil, no good, nothing but blind, pitiless indifference. There are no criteria for deciding what is good and what is bad. Well, you might say, what's good for the well-being of society? That's good. But ideas differ hugely on what is good for society. In the first half of the 20th century, many countries, including the USA and the UK, but particularly Germany, had large programs of eugenics, not just Germany. They were designed to improve society by removing individuals seen as mentally or physically challenged. That's what IQ tests were originally designed for. Now we've changed our minds. We call that murder. But the pendulum could easily swing back the other way. In the interests of giving evolution a helping hand in improving the human race, the pendulum could easily swing back. Pushed to the limit, any kind of behaviour can be justified on the basis of propagating our selfish genes. Nearly 80% of Americans believe in God, but 67% say there are no moral absolutes. Sounds confused over there. I'd say there was quite a bit of confusion in American society there. A poll asked Americans what they would be willing to do for $10 million. 25% said they would abandon their entire family. 25% said they would abandon their church. 23% said they would become prostitutes for a short length of time. 16% said they would give up their American citizenship. Another 16% would leave their spouses. 10% would withhold testimony and let a murderer escape justice. 7% would kill a stranger. Think of that when you're walking down the street in America. 7% would kill a stranger. $10 million, but still. 3% would put their children up for adoption. Now, these are the consequences of no moral absolutes. And believe me, the situation is not better here in the UK. In fact, it's probably a lot worse. Now, naturalists see themselves as bravely and strong-mindedly accepting the reality that science has revealed. But others are looking for something more. You know, Ronald Knox once found himself embroiled in a theological argument with the scientist John Scott Haldane. In a universe containing millions of planets, Haldane asked, isn't it inevitable that life will appear on at least one of them? Well, Knox replied, if Scotland Yard found a body in your suitcase, would you tell them there are millions of suitcases in the world, surely one of them must contain a body? I think they would still want to know who put the body there. So there's a second major worldview, and it revolves around the idea of God, a non-material being who's outside nature, not just a glorified man or woman. Nature is not all there is in this scenario. God is eternal. He existed before the fabric of space-time came into existence, and he will have no end. He created the universe and our world, and he designed and created life. So God himself is immortal, and most Christian forms of theism believe in some form of immortality for human beings. Seventh-day Adventists, for example, believe in a resurrection, while many mainline Christian churches believe individuals possess immortal souls. Now, the immortality of God and of the human race guarantees a continuity to history and to human society. So the individual's thoughts, feelings, and achievements will be remembered in this view. Our actions and ideas are not ephemeral and essentially meaningless, but they'll have value into the far future, in the eyes of our peers, as well as in the eyes of God. So the triumphs of art and literature and science aren't all going to dissipate into nothingness, but will remain as landmarks down the future. Have you ever been affirmed or commended by your spouse or your boss or someone you respect? I'm not seeing many nodding heads out there, but I can tell you it's a great feeling and it makes life worthwhile. Imagine then the meaning and value that develop in your life when your actions or achievements are commended by a being of such surpassing intelligence and power as the one who created the cosmos. Theism also provides an absolute basis for moral values. In the Christian version of theism, moral values are based on the character of God himself. He put in place an ethical system that's good for the physical, material, and spiritual well-being of individuals and of human societies. Furthermore, because of immortality, we can expect that the terrible injustices of history, the appalling wrongs and sufferings of innocents that cause us so much agony when we read about them and hear about them in the news, we can expect that those things will eventually be righted. Justice will eventually prevail, or rather than everything going off into nothingness. Now, these aspects of theism bring rationality, hope, and meaning and purpose into life. Now, there is a third way, known as theistic evolution, which mixes evolution and theism together. The idea being that God somehow directed the forces of nature and of evolution to produce the world and life as we see it. Many traditional Christian churches support this view, as well as many prominent scientists. Now, I respect this viewpoint, but I don't favour it myself. I don't have time to explain why now, because I promised to update you on the origins debate rather than carrying on this discussion. So what have recent discoveries to say about these competing worldviews? Well, as you know, the Large Hadron Collider started up at CERN in Geneva, and it's led to a lot of exciting announcements, mostly in areas of science I must admit that I know almost nothing about. One interesting event was when the world-famous scientist Stephen Hawking published a new book called The Grand Design: New Answers to the Ultimate Questions of Life. There he is on that overhead, working on it with Leonard Mlodinow. Now, in his previous book, A Short History of Time, Hawking was a little bit ambivalent about whether he believed in God or not. He didn't make that too clear. But in this book, he comes out squarely on the side of the new atheists. The grand universal theory that Hawking promotes is called M-theory, and he regards it as the ultimate theory, a theory of supersymmetric gravity that will explain everything. Hawking and Mlodinow write that if M-theory is true, then there is no God. Furthermore, he wrote, because there is a law such as gravity, the universe can and will create itself from nothing. Now, it's no exaggeration to say that Hawking's book has run into an avalanche of criticism from scientists and philosophers alike. Oxford professor of mathematics John Lennox has written two books detailing his reason for rejecting what Hawking says. There's a small but very readable book called God and Stephen Hawking, and there's another one called Gunning for God, why the new atheists are missing the mark. Not only does this book refute Hawking's grand design, but it goes further to examine the wider claims of the new atheists. Now, on Hawking's statement about the universe creating itself, Lennox points out that this is presupposing the universe in order to have it create itself. If the universe is needed in order to create itself, then it's already there, so it doesn't need creating. This is a logical fallacy. It's what's called an incoherent statement. Then Hawking asks us to believe that the law of gravity is the agency responsible for creation. Now, Lennox explains that the laws of physics can't create anything. They're merely a description of what normally happens under certain conditions. Lennox mentions the jet engine as an example. By Hawking's reasoning, the laws of physics on their own could create the jet engine. But actually, the intelligence and engineering work of Sir Frank Whittle, together with materials and metals, were needed to create the jet engine. The laws of physics explain how the jet engine works, but they can't create it, or the matter from which it was made. Lennox mentions another example. Suppose I put £1,000 into the bank. Sometime later, I put another £1,000 into the bank. Then the laws of maths tell me that 1,000 plus 1,000 equals 2,000, and I'll have £2,000 in the bank. Suppose, however, that I put £1,000 in the bank, and I don't put anything else in, I'll wait for the laws of mathematics and the laws of physics to increase the amount in the bank for me. Now, how long am I going to wait until I have £2,000 in the bank if I leave the laws of physics and maths to do it for me? It's never going to happen. Now, in the same way, the law of gravitation cannot create gravity or the material on which gravity acts. The idea of a theory or physical laws bringing the universe into existence just doesn't make sense. The world of strict naturalism, in which clever mathematical laws all by themselves bring the universe into existence, is pure science fiction. Now, I don't know much about M theory, I must admit, except that it's a mathematical construct that may or may not have relevance to reality. It relates to the vibrations of minute, tiny, tiny, almost infinitesimally small strings or membranes in 11 dimensions. We have no evidence whatsoever that we're living in an 11-dimensional world or that these infinitesimally small membranes exist. So I'm going to let the experts speak for themselves. On M theory, the well-known physicist Paul Davies says, it's not testable, not in any foreseeable future. Oxford physicist Frank Close, I don't see that M theory adds one iota to the God debate, either pro or con. And then John Butterworth, who works on the Large Hadron Collider in Switzerland. M theory is highly speculative and certainly not in the zone of science that we've got any evidence for. It seems that Hawking is letting his atheist ideology lead his science by the nose. Now, physicists working on the Large Hadron Collider have been looking to confirm another foundational theory of physics called supersymmetry. It's a crucial component in the standard model of particle physics. Supersymmetry predicts that the normal particles of physics should have supersymmetric shadow particles, partner particles that are much greater in mass. Then the Large Hadron Collider carries out extremely high energy collisions from which traces of these large mass superparticles, including the famous Higgs boson, they should appear. Lots of experiments have been carried out now, but without finding the expected results, and worried reports are appearing in the literature. as of September this year, no meaningful signs of the superpartners have been observed by the Large Hadron Collider. According to Professor Jordan Nash, Imperial College London, he works on the Large Hadron Collider experiments, the fact that we haven't seen any evidence of it, that supersymmetry, tells that either our understanding of it is incomplete, or it's a little different to what we thought, or maybe it doesn't exist at all. However, supersymmetry is a very flexible theory, so it's too early to definitely rule it out. But obviously, this foundational theory of matter is not so solid as we were once led to believe. Now, another very interesting result from CERN is their tests on the speed of light. I don't know if you picked up on this, but in September, CERN announced that neutrinos sent through the ground from Geneva toward the Gran Sasso laboratory, 732 kilometres away in Italy, showed up a tiny fraction of a second too soon. That is, they travelled faster than the speed of light. The scientists themselves are puzzled about this, and they're asking the scientific community to try and help them explain what they did wrong. Now, there's a lot of scepticism about this result. One noted scientist, offered to eat his jacket if it's proved to be true. I was amused to read that financial institutions are already looking at ways to exploit the faster-than-light trick. They announced plans, I think tongue-in-cheek, to set up optimal points for financial transactions to originate. So they'll be midway between two financial hubs. So this will maximise their chance of buying low at one financial centre and selling high in the other financial centre with the aid of a faster-than-light trick. As I say, I suspect that that's tongue-in-cheek, but it sounds appealing if you want to make a lot of money. Now, that isn't the only puzzling result recently. Observations from the so-called Very Large Telescope, based in Chile, found that one of the universal constants of physics, the alpha constant, may not be constant after all. This is also called the fine structure constant, and it characterises the strength of the electromagnetic interaction. In September last year, Professor Webb measured alpha from redshifts of quasars, and he found small variations depending on their direction in space. In October this year, Webb's team confirmed these observations and showed that alpha depends on direction. It increases in the southern direction and decreases in the northern direction. Now, it's absolutely axiomatic in cosmology that physical laws and constants are the same everywhere in space. Otherwise, huge questions hang over many key theories and findings. Now, all these results seem very extraordinary and upsetting. They call into question some of the most fundamental assumptions about the stuff that nature is composed of and the fabric of space-time itself. Of course, the results are tentative, and we mustn't jump to any final conclusions. But it's been made abundantly clear that the basic theories of physics, those on which the Big Bang and other cosmological results are based, are by no means as clear-cut, as cut-and-dried as the naturalists would have us believe. It's obvious they're much more uncertain and speculative than we'd previously thought. I think a bit more humility is needed, together with an openness to alternative views and explanations. Do you remember the story of how Sherlock Holmes and Dr. Watson went camping? They pitched their tent under the stars and went to sleep. Sometime in the night, Holmes woke Watson up. "Watson, look up at the stars and tell me what you deduce." "Well," Watson said, "I see millions of stars, and even if a few of those have planets, it's quite likely that there are some planets like Earth, and if there are a few planets like Earth out there, then life might well evolve." "Watson, you idiot, somebody stole our tent. said Holmes. Now, I think in their fascination with grand universal theories, the scientists are a bit like Watson. They're missing something obvious. And in the area of origins, the obvious thing that they're missing is design. Stephen Hawking comments in that book that the universe and its laws appear to have a design that's tailor-made to support life. I'm quoting his very words. Richard Dawkins admits the appearance of design throughout the biological world. But both these scientists insist it's only apparent design. It's accounted for by natural processes working according to physical and evolutionary laws. That's how they see it. However, recent developments, it seems to me, have made the argument for a designer much stronger and more substantial. The catalyst for this was Watson and Crick's discovery in 1953 of the structure of DNA. During the next decades, the science of molecular biology began its rise to stardom. The fantastically complex structures of many cell components were gradually worked out. And the huge challenge that the amazing organization and information content of these biological structures poses for evolutionary theory began to be appreciated. Now, DNA is made up of a long string of units called nucleotides. There are just four different nucleotides. Letters A, G, C, and T designate them. And they're usually just called bases for short. So I'll sometimes say bases, I'll sometimes say nucleotides. I'm using those two terms interchangeably. RNA is a close relative of DNA. It's also a long chain of nucleotides, but slightly different ones. Now, it's the exact order in which these bases appear, in which these bases are arranged on the DNA, that determines the information the DNA carries, and hence the proteins that the cell containing the DNA can build. Each nucleotide chain associates with a complementary chain, and then they twist up into this double helix that Watson and Crick worked out. Now, the really significant thing about DNA is that the nucleotides can be linked together in any order. They're not forced to appear in any particular order. They can appear in any order. The sequences don't show any regularities. There's no law that predicts them. And it's been realized that instead, they bear a striking resemblance to letter sequences, words, and phrases in sentences. Just as you can assemble letters in any order to make words, so nucleotides can be assembled in any order to make information on the DNA. Languages convey meaning, that's information, from one mind to another, according to the rules of the language they're written in. Similarly, a computer machine code instructs the computer to perform some function. In the same way, the base sequences of DNA instruct the cell ribosome-based machinery to build a particular type of protein. So the base sequences in DNA also constitute what's known as information. They're not just complexity, they're actually information. But it takes intelligent agents to produce information. It takes an intelligent agent to produce information in prose, in writing, or in computer software. Prose or poetry requires a Shakespeare to string the letters together. Of course, we can do it as well. You don't have to be quite as clever as Shakespeare. And then the instructions in a computer code also appear from the mind of an intelligent programmer. It needs a geek, a computer geek, to write a machine code that will make the computer do something you want. information comes only from intelligent minds. So to summarise, DNA nucleotide sequences bear a striking resemblance to words and sentences in written languages, or to symbol sequences in computer codes. Words convey meaning from one mind to another. The characters in a computer code instruct the computer how to perform some function. DNA sequences convey meaning via the genetic code to the cell protein-making machinery. Information communicated in written languages is produced by conscious, intelligent agents. In fact, information is only produced by intelligent minds. So the information coded in nucleotide sequences must also have originated from an intelligent mind. It's powerful evidence that an intelligent mind was at work in the origin of living things. Now, there's a second powerful argument pointing towards a designer, and it's also emerged in the last decades or so. Molecular biology has been revealing the remarkably complex nature of components found in cells. There are cilia, bacterial flagella, vision cascades, chloroplasts, and so on. These are structures found in cells. And in these cell components, many complex, specialized proteins mesh with one another, just like parts in a machine. They're called biological machines or molecular machines. And a very large number of these, hundreds, in fact, perhaps thousands of such machines have been discovered. This slide shows a very small selection of them, including the ATP synthase system, which has a rotor that spins round and a stator, just like an electric motor. The bacterial flagellum, the little filament that helps a bacterium to swim along, also acts like a propeller, but it also has a motor, very like that one, that drives the flagellum. Now, these motors are some of the most incredible structures found anywhere in the universe. They're made from 30 or 40 special protein molecules, and as I mentioned, they have rotors and stators, just like electric motors. They can rotate at 15,000, maybe even 20,000 revs per minute. That's roughly the same as a Formula One car engine. But they're practically frictionless and close to 100% efficient. Yet they're micro-miniature in size. The type 1 photosystem that I've got there converts light energy into useful chemicals. Protein synthesis takes place at the ribosome. Bacteria rhodopsin is a proton pump, and it captures light energy and uses it to transport protons. And then the type 3 secretory system is used by some bacteria to inject toxins. Now, the organized complexity of these molecular machines is amazing. They combine many specialized proteins, closely coordinated in space and time. And this makes it practically impossible that they could have just assembled themselves by some random Darwinian process. I'd like you to just have a look at a video now, just a clip from a video, which gives a simplified version of protein synthesis at the ribosome.
With computer animation, we can enter the cell to view this remarkable system at work.
There's the DNA. See the double helix there?
After entering the heart of the cell, we see the tightly wound strands of DNA, storehouses for the instructions necessary to build every protein in an organism. In a process known as transcription, A molecular machine first unwinds a section of the DNA helix to expose the genetic instructions needed to assemble a specific protein molecule. Another machine then copies these instructions to form a molecule known as messenger RNA. When transcription is complete, the slender RNA strand carries the genetic information through the nuclear pore complex, the gatekeeper for traffic in and out of the cell nucleus. The messenger RNA strand is directed to a two-part molecular factory called a ribosome. After attaching itself securely, the process of translation begins. Inside the ribosome, a molecular assembly line builds a specifically sequenced chain of amino acids. These amino acids are transported from other parts of the cell and then linked into chains often hundreds of units long. Their sequential arrangement determines the type of protein manufactured.
See the protein forming along the bottom there.
When the chain is finished, it is moved from the ribosome to a barrel-shaped machine
so
that helps fold it into the precise shape critical to its function. After the chain is folded into a protein, it is then released and shepherded by another molecular machine to the exact location where it is needed.
See another molecule?
This is absolute.
That just fits it, comes up, it's called a chaperone molecule, and that will now take the protein to the place in the cell where it will perform the function that it was designed to perform. Have a look. You saw, I hope, the large number of complex and specialized proteins. That's a much simplified account of what actually goes on. There are more proteins, more specialized proteins, about 100 in all, that are involved in that process. And their shapes are exactly designed to match and interact in the right way. And events are synchronized in time. I hope you noticed that, so that the protein building proceeds efficiently. The whole cell is like a beautifully designed and interconnecting factory. Cells are not just bags of chemicals where random mutations and combinations can just happen to produce something novel. Random happenings are catastrophic in cells, and they disrupt the kind of order that you saw there, and they result in cell death. Now, the existence of these microminiature machines is also powerful evidence for design. Can the neo-Darwinian mechanism really accomplish the miracles that are expected of it? An Amish boy and his father were visiting a shopping mall. They were amazed by many things that they saw there, but especially by a small room or compartment with shiny doors that slid apart and then closed again. The boy asked his father, "What is that, father?" "Son, I've never seen anything like it," said his father. They watched wide-eyed as an old lady hobbled up on sticks and pressed a button. The wall slid open. The old lady hobbled inside, and the walls closed again. Lights winked on and off above the thing, and then they winked on and off in the other direction. And then the Amish watched, open-mouthed, as a beautiful young lady stepped out. "Son," said his father, "that must be Darwin's black box. Go and get your mother." Now, from about the 1980s, gene sequencing, that's the ability to actually determine the order of these nucleotides in the DNA that comes from different sources, it gradually became easier for scientists to determine that order. And then during the 90s and noughties, huge strides were made as automated machinery for doing this was developed. This overhead shows one such instrument with the colour-coded gels that are produced and the computer printout of the nucleotide sequence. More and more genes have been sequenced, culminating in February 2001 with the publication of the complete human genome. This technique put a powerful new tool into the hands of scientists and opened a whole new window onto the study of biological relationships. This was a tremendous opportunity for neo-Darwinism to be confirmed and for creationism to be decisively killed off. So what actually happened? Well, I'm sure you remember the phylogenetic tree, Darwin's tree of life. On the left is the original sketch that Darwin made, and on the right is a more modern one based, they're based on anatomical comparisons of living and fossil species, comparing their shape and size and physiology and so on. It's a powerful and picturesque way of illustrating how every species that ever lived is supposed to be related to all others right back to the origin of life. It's one of the most iconic symbols of neo-Darwinian evolution, and it's been absolutely central to the thinking of evolutionary biologists for at least 150 years. Many have devoted their entire lives to constructing little bits of it. Now, the DNA sequencing techniques opened up an exciting prospect. Could they confirm this traditional anatomical phylogenetic tree by comparison with an independently created molecular tree? The critical idea was that more closely related species are, then the more alike their DNA sequences and the corresponding RNA sequences ought to be. The earliest sequencing experiments in the 70s and 80s were pretty difficult and laborious. So the data was first found for RNAs of ribosomes, the cell's protein-making machines. By comparing the RNA sequences from ribosomes in bacteria, plants, and animals, molecular biologists began to map the outlines of a molecular tree. The original results, the first results, looked good for neo-Darwinism. By the mid-1980s, there was great optimism that the definitive universal tree of life would emerge, triumphantly unifying the anatomical and molecular areas of evolutionary biology. There were lots of announcements claiming full vindication of the classic tree in popular science articles, in books, in TV presentations. If you saw some of those presentations in Darwin's bicentenary year, you'll see they were still claiming it then. I saw quite a number of scientists saying it then. However, the automatic machines now came on stream, and in the 90s and noughties, DNA itself came under study, and troubling data began to appear when sequences from actual DNA of different organisms and much bigger range of organisms began to appear. Sometimes these DNA sequences agreed with the RNA molecular tree, but sometimes they didn't. Sometimes a different tree resulted. As more and more genes were sequenced, a flood of different trees began to emerge. Some evolutionary biologists began talking about a forest of trees. Others proposed nets or webs of relationships. A deluge of conflicting evidence from the DNA of bacteria, and archaea shattered the phylogenetic tree concept for the domains of microorganisms. Dalhousie University biologist Ford Doolittle made the provocative claim that the history of life cannot properly be represented as a tree. At first, it seemed it was only for microorganisms that the tree need be abandoned. However, as more and more genomes were sequenced, ever more incongruous bits of DNA were turning up. If there is a tree of life, it's a small anomalous structure growing out of the web of life. It's part of a revolutionary change in biology. Our standard model of evolution is under enormous pressure. So said John Dupré. Science writer Graham Lawton quotes several experts admitting that recent results reveal that the evolution of animals and plants isn't exactly tree-like either. Here's a quote. Sivanen recently compared 2,000 genes that are common to humans, frogs, sea squirts, sea urchins, fruit flies, and nematodes. In theory, he should have been able to use the gene sequences to construct an evolutionary tree, showing the relationships between the six animals, but he failed. The problem was that different genes told contradictory evolutionary stories. This was especially true of the sea squirt genes. Having uprooted the tree of unicellular life for microorganisms, biologists were now taking their axes to the remaining branches. Michael Rose, University of California, was revealingly honest. The tree of life is being politely buried. We all know that, he said. What's less accepted is that a whole fundamental view of biology needs to change. Michael Sivanen, University of California, was equally frank. We've just annihilated the tree of life. It's not a tree anymore. It's a different topology entirely. Of course, not all scientists agree. By carefully selecting which data to include and which to exclude, it's of course possible to construct impressive-seeming phylogenetic trees. Professor Bork at Heidelberg continues to defend the tree concept and believes that a tree signal can be discerned by selecting base sequences from certain genes. However, it's clear that this central tenet of neo-Darwinism has radically lost ground. Far from confirming the traditional phylogenetic tree, the anatomical one, the independent molecular tree gave webs and networks greatly at odds with it. Neo-Darwinism had failed another test. Now, sadly, this didn't induce many professional biologists to question the validity of neo-Darwinian evolution itself. Rather, the complex networks that were revealed began to be interpreted in terms of a process called horizontal gene transfer, HGT. And it's now supposed that species swap genetic material by hybridization and that viruses and bacteria pick it up and pass it on. Geneticists now believe HGT is very common in all types of organisms, but of course this is very speculative. It involves the acceptance of a whole new range of hypothetical narrative scenarios, such as that early bacteria and archaea fused their genes to produce multicellular organisms, that bacteria with nuclei engulfed other microorganisms, giving rise to mitochondria and chloroplasts, and so on. These are unique and unrepeatable events. They've not been observed in the laboratory. They're not observed under controlled scientific testing. This is another journey into what's called promissory science. The neo-Darwinian check is still in the post. Then another pillar of neo-Darwinism is the anatomical homology concept. I guess most of you remember this from school. Generations of biologists, including Darwin himself, used it as a foundational argument in favour of evolution. The similarities that are observed across many species, for example, the bone structures of the forelimbs of the bat, porpoise, hoist, human, resemble one another. I've tried to illustrate that on this slide. These are called homologous structures. And they were cited as strong evidence for descent from a common ancestor. Now, the information that guides the building of the limbs and other anatomical structures actually descends from parent to offspring in the form of genetic instructions, which are passed on in the DNA, which is contained in egg and sperm. So Neo-Darwinism predicts that homologous, equivalent body parts would have been built by homologous or similar genes. And we can study this by DNA sequencing. And DNA sequencing has shown that this is wrong. It was discovered that homologous structures can be produced by different genes and can arise from completely different developmental pathways. I'll just show you one example of this because we don't have much time. Here are the body segments of fruit flies and wasps. You see how similar they are. They're homologous. This was formerly said to be evidence of their close common ancestry. However, comparisons of the DNA sequences of their genes showed they arise from entirely different developmental pathways. So, in this case, homology was not evidence for common descent. Neo-Darwinism also predicted that non-homologous structures should result from non-homologous genes. But again, many cases have been found in which the same genes play an important role in building dissimilar structures. I've put one example up there. The wiring of the eyes of the squid, the fruit fly and the mouse are very different. Yet the same gene, called PAX6, is involved in the development of all of them. Now, because of these grave difficulties, and for other reasons, many biologists have abandoned the notion that homology is evidence of evolution. After generations of teaching this to be the case, it's going out of favour. Quite a lot have abandoned it. Then there's the junk DNA saga. Now, I've talked about this in a former year here, so I'm not going to say very much about it, but it's been rolling along for about a decade now. Evolutionary biologists predicted that the genomes of modern organisms would be full of fossil DNA left over from previous ancestors but no longer useful. This is what Jerry Coyne, in his book Why Evolution is True, said. We expect to find in the genomes of many species silenced or dead genes, genes that once were useful and are no longer intact or expressed. In other words, there should be vestigial genes. In contrast, the idea that all species were created from scratch predicts that no such genes would exist, since there would be no common ancestors in which those genes were active. Again, the DNA sequencing techniques have been put to work. Events have overtaken and overturned this view. Evidence is pouring in from genome sequencing projects around the globe that shows that virtually all of an organism's DNA is transcribed into RNA, and that most of the RNA, although it's not used to make proteins, it performs other essential regulatory functions. Every month, science journals publish more articles describing more of these functions. The evidence has been remorselessly accumulating that the so-called junk DNA is not useless, it's not fossil, it's not residual. And it's become increasingly clear that junk DNA is a misnomer, that it's an essential resource. Jonathan Wells has recently published a book called The Myth of Junk DNA. He goes into great detail in this book explaining the functions that are being discovered for so-called junk DNA. I've put up a list of them there on the slide. I'm not going to read it, but that's just a few of the functions that have been found. And this list of functions for so-called junk DNA is getting longer and longer all the time. Frank Slack, reporting on a symposium on the theme regulatory RNAs, formerly supposed to be junk, said, "We're fast learning that large portions of the genome that do not code for proteins are in fact transcribed, and that those regions previously thought to be junk may be useful after all." So it's evident that the evolutionary predictions of dead and vestigial DNA have been refuted. Galileo was a young professor at Pisa, and he had quite an argument with some of the older ones about the correctness of Aristotle's theory that a heavyweight will fall faster than a light one. And he offered to prove his point. His demonstration was made from the Leaning Tower of Pisa. And he gathered a large audience of university people, and he dropped a 10-pound weight, a 10-pound iron ball, and a 1-pound iron ball from the top of the tower, and he let them go simultaneously. Much to the amazement and the chagrin of everybody except Galileo, the two balls hit the ground at exactly the same moment. But that didn't convince the professors. They hissed Galileo. They accused him of using magic. And they went on following Aristotle's theory. Now, I know the details of this story are apocryphal. It didn't actually happen quite like that. But the outcome was very much as portrayed. And the same is happening today. In spite of the experimental evidence against neo-Darwinism, its supporters accuse critics of religious superstition, of being anti-science, and they go right on believing in Darwin. So what are my conclusions today? Well, first of all, the laws of nature can't create anything. They describe how things work, but they can't create anything. The idea that some basic theory of physics like M theory abolishes God, we can dismiss such ideas. Recent findings from the Large Hadron Collider show that grand universal theory should be regarded as tentative. They're much more tentative than we've been told. And then, in the realm of biology, I'm not campaigning for the abolition of evolution, just for it to be downsized. Many examples of changes in colour or dimensions of species are documented in the literature. Textbooks of evolution show these. Changes in finch beak sizes, coloration of peppered moths, limb sizes of tree lizards. Dark deer mice developed sandy coats when they lived on sand dunes. Bacteria developed resistance to antibiotics. These minor changes should really be called microevolution. Small extent evolution of this kind did occur in the past, and it is occurring today. It's not controversial. It's accepted by all sides. Neo-Darwinians, creationists. They suppose that living organisms have the ability to adapt within limits to changing environmental and ecological conditions. The evidence for macroevolution, that's the emergence of new species with new organs, new body plans, or other new biological structures that require novel genetic information, that's completely lacking. There's no experimental evidence for this. So the DNA sequencing uprooted Darwin's iconic tree of life. It's shown that anatomical homology is not evidence for common descent, and then it's steadily disproving Neo-Darwinian prediction of genomes containing vestigial, dead, junk DNA. It's high time that neo-Darwinian evolution joined all the other grandiose universal systems that originated in the 19th century. Freudian psychology, largely discounted. Marxist sociology, for the most part discredited. Yet in biology, we're still having to live with this neo-Darwinian relict of Victorian optimism. Evolution's pretensions to be a grand universal theory encompassing vast reaches of biological science haven't stood up. It ought to be recognised for what it is, a limited theory that helps to explain minor microevolutionary changes and adaptations. Now, all this is very significant from the point of view of the world view that you adopt. The other side of the coin is that the new evidence I've talked about has made design so much more believable. It's possible to follow a trail of evidence. And that trail starts from the discovery of the exquisitely organized nature of cells and the design of their biological machinery. Then we have the realization that the nucleotide sequences of DNA represent coded information, but only intelligent minds are sources of information. So the trail leads insistently back to a designer. This evidence makes belief in theism, a creator God, much more defensible and more rational. So the trail ends in the traditional belief in creation first enunciated in Genesis. Well, I'm nearly done. Laura McKenzie drew up her car at a red light on a road in the outback in Australia. She was in for a long delay. The traffic light remained stuck on red. She waited patiently for it to change. On and on she waited. Eventually, 2 days later, another driver found her slumped over the wheel of her car, suffering from dehydration. Later, in hospital, she said, "How was I supposed to know? The lights were broken. It was red, so I waited. I waited for it to change." Now, grand universal evolution, it seems to me, has been stuck on a red light, stuck there for decades now. Always we're told, well, the missing link has just turned up, or scientists are on the verge of creating life, or this computer simulation models evolution exactly. The geneticists have found definitive proof. But the check has been in the post for generations now. It's time to downsize neo-Darwinism and acknowledge the strength of the evidence for design and for a creator. Thank you very much.